she's a good girl. Loves her mama, loves Jesus in America.
2:45 on 720 WGN. Thanks for staying up late with us, everybody. Matt Bubala here with you on Radio 720 WGN. Sammy Chittum joins us on the phone right now. She is the author of The Flight 981 Disaster, Tragedy, Treachery, and the Pursuit of the Truth. Sammy, thank you so much for jumping on the phone with us. How are you this morning?
I'm doing just great, Matt. How are you?
Good. Thank you for staying up a little bit late tonight. We do appreciate it. I finished the book today. It was fascinating. I have a weird fascination with plane crashes, but I'm sure you hear that a lot. And I'm sure as you research this, what was it like to go through all of this so many years later, and the people you talked to that revisited this, I would imagine, for the first time in a while, right?
Yes, actually, because this took place such a long time ago, 1974, more than four decades ago, many of the principal players are no longer even alive, so I had to approach this much more like a historian than like a journalist, which is where most of my background is. I had to look at a lot of documents, but this accident was so horrible, so heartbreaking, so disturbing, going through the cockpit voice recorder, looking at the transcripts, talking to people. It all came back again in a very profound way. And like you, I find these accidents fascinating, but there's also a great deal that we can learn from them, especially regarding really tough lessons and what caused the crash and how to prevent a recurrence.
Well, and that's the amazing story about this book, Sammy, because it's not just, and I watch air disasters on the Smithsonian Channel, and I watch why planes go down on the Weather Channel, and I'm fascinated by it. And I was mentioning earlier that Malcolm Gladwell in his book, The Outliers, I believe that's the book I read this in, did a whole section on plane crashes and how it's never generally one thing. It's usually a series of things that went wrong that end up resulting in an air disaster. And in this instance, maybe not with this particular crash, but you detail the because the whole disaster, of course, is fascinating in its macabre way. But the way that McDonnell Douglas built this plane had problems from the absolute get-go with this plane. But because they were in a rush to make sales, because they had to get this plane in the air, and because of the relationship between the aircraft carriers at the time and the aircraft producers and the FAA, shortcuts were allowed to happen, corrections that were clearly spelled out several times. And that's it must be so frustrating for family members to read this account, because this was just terrible negligence on the part of so many players who had the easy ability to say, this has to be fixed, this has to be changed, and this accident never should have happened.
No, it never should have happened. And Robert Wheel, who lost his wife, Wendy Wheel, in the crash, really was not just heartbroken, but understandably very angry. He really considered it not an accident, but a lot closer to manslaughter. And you summed up exactly what happened perfectly. I mean, it was an entirely preventable accident. McDonnell Douglas was told about this internally. They were told about this by the NTSB, and they simply didn't address it, and 346 people died as a result of it.
At the time, the largest aviation disaster at the time in history, correct? 346 souls lost?
Yes. So the largest in history, and really catastrophic. I mean, the accident seems like something out of a war movie or a horror film. The plane was just decimated, and all the bodies and the parts of the plane were scattered all over the forest. It was the first jumbo jet accident, and it really stunned the world.
So let's step back just for a minute. So Flight 981 was a flight from Paris to London. The airline what was the name of the airline? It's not Turkish National. What was it?
It was Turkish Airlines.
So it's a Turkish airliner flying a DC-10, which was a relatively brand new aircraft that McDonnell Douglas came out with very quickly in response to Boeing producing the 747, the world's first true jumbo jet. Sales were off the charts for that. McDonnell Douglas,
yes,
as well as another company, was it Lockheed Martin? Was it Lockheed who
That's
was also?
That's right, Lockheed Martin. Yeah, they were in a race with Lockheed Martin to get a new big plane out into the market and try to capture some of that market.
Yeah, to get a competitor out there. And they decided not to make something as big as the 747, but something that also could fly overseas, but handle cargo, handle a lot of passengers. While the Boeing at max, the 747 could seat about 500, right? But this maxed out at like 350. Right. Is that right, the DC-10?
That's right. Yeah, that's right. It was that day, it was a full flight.
Right.
Because there had been a strike on, and almost every seat was taken on the plane, which, of course, made it even worse.
And the crazy thing about that, as I'm reading about it, Sammy, because if people so I was 3 years old when this accident happened, so I hadn't flown at all yet, really. But and I remember air travel from 20 years ago, but let's face it, most of us don't really remember flights before 9/11 at this point. And so the crazy thing is reading about, so the strike is going on in Paris. So a bunch of people jump on this flight at the last minute, think about it, you know, not going through metal detectors, not doing all the things we usually do, buying tickets in cash, buying one-way tickets, or somebody buys a ticket, but then decides not to take it and hands it to somebody else. So they didn't even have a flight manifest that knew every single person who was on board that plane. And you write about some of the families that, you know, the one family I remember reading about where the father had left to go on a business trip. He was headed to Africa. And his secretary, you know, and so they're sitting there reading about this accident, not knowing that their father was on this flight, knew he had a flight and he was leaving. But the secretary calls the house a couple days later saying, I haven't heard from him. Have you guys heard from him? He always checks in when he arrives. And that's when they realize nobody's hearing from him. He might have been on this flight. They go to France, where, you know, nobody in the world is prepared for this type of disaster, because nothing like this has ever happened, right, with this many people. And so you write about how in what was an abandoned church in the small town in France outside of Paris where this happened, they're gathering all the belongings of the family. So there's a whole setup of shoes on the floor and handbags and earrings and wedding rings and all these things that family members can come sift through. And they found, I believe it was his briefcase handle with his initials on it, right? And like one other thing.
Yes.
And that's how the only way that they knew that his father was actually on this flight. I just can't imagine what families went through at that time.
Well, you know, now it was, as you described, it was very chaotic when everyone was boarding in Paris and there wasn't a manifest. So it was really a forensic nightmare trying to figure out who was on the plane and who wasn't. And it's hard for us to understand that now, because everything is, you know, you've got your driver's license and it's all, you know, it's very important to know who's getting on the plane. But that wasn't the case then at all. There was so much about the accident, every phase of it and the aftermath you just described. How people had to actually go sort through their loved ones' possessions to try to find something and try to make a connection with what had happened to them. It was a huge trauma for Britain. There were a lot of Brits on the plane, not as many Americans. And quite frankly, the accident resonated more in Europe. I was 20 at the time this took place, and this is at the height of Watergate. That's what I remember, you know. And it was the British journalists, the Sunday Times journalists who spent a year digging into this and really exposed what happened. But, I think a lot of Americans aren't even familiar with the extent of this, the trauma of it and the scandal that it created.
Well, I think that this is a really somewhat unknown air disaster here in America, possibly because we had two much more famous ones with DC-10s, especially here in Chicago in 1979, we had the American Airlines flight, and then Flight 232, the one that crashed famously in Sioux City, and especially that one because there was some footage captured of that one coming down and landing, which
very, very haunting. Yes, absolutely.
So there's a lot to tell in this story. I want to get to a lot of it here. Let me just start with the basics of this, and then we'll move on, and we'll keep going through the story, Sammy, if it's okay. So when McDonnell Douglas starts, and you tell the really wonderful, the way you tell the history of McDonnell, the McDonnell Aircraft Corporation, the Douglas Aircraft Corporation, why they ended up merging and what happened, and the DC-3, and all the great history of how really civil aviation started in this country and the Mavericks who were behind it.
Yes.
But when we get to McDonnell Douglas at the time of the DC-10, the company had been taken over by McDonnell Aircraft Corporation because the Douglas Aircraft Corporation was on the verge of bankruptcy. And then Boeing's got this plane out. They got to hurry up and get this plane out. And in the past, when there used to be maybe one person who really oversaw the development of a plane and was the one who would put their foot down if something was wrong, we just kind of had a perfect storm of bad events here where there's thousands of engineers at McDonnell Douglas building this plane.
Right.
They are under intense pressure to hurry up and get it in production. And the biggest thing was they designed this plane and we're going to get this out. And now we have to get this plane in production and we have to get as much weight off of it as possible. We want a lighter plane because it's carrying a lot of people. They want it to be able to carry a lot of cargo. The lighter it is, the less fuel it's going to need. That saves the carriers money. They made promises. So now you said it was like Weight Watchers meetings where there's all these things on the board listed as how are we going to save weight on this? Anything that's not necessary, get rid of it. Any material, you can use a lighter material, use a lighter material. And of course, that led to a decent amount of shortcuts. And the problem comes in, the biggest problem comes in the design of the cargo door. And you wrote that every plane up until then had more of like a tub plug where the door moved inside. So when you close it, it's coming out. And then when it gets pressurized, the pressure's on the door, but the door can't go out because it's sort of like a drain plug. It pushes into the little hole where it's going to go. And because they wanted to save space and save weight, they, for the first time, put a door that opened out on the cargo door. But the problem comes in how they close that. The latching system they come up with is a bit complex. But what's worse is there's no way to truly know that the door is closed because it's not pulling out and sealing. It's coming down with, instead of using hydraulics, they're using electrical actuators, I believe it is.
Yeah, and you have it exactly, Matt. You've got it exactly. You're getting an A+ on this.
Well, I actually read the book, Sammy. I really enjoyed the book, and I read it all this week. And so the door is not locking properly as far as the problem is maybe it is locking properly, but if it's not, they can't truly tell. And it's
building
the plane, when the plane is still in the hangar and they're testing the pressurization and the air conditioning for the first time, the door blows out before they've ever built the damn plane. They blow the door out and they don't say, hey, that's a problem. Now, the subcontractor of the door had written this lengthy memo to McDonnell Douglas saying, hey, there's problems here. McDonnell Douglas basically ignores it, sends the report off to the FAA, deleting out the problems they don't want to acknowledge. And
so they
make a little change where they add a handle, a vent handle, so that when you shut it, if it doesn't close properly, the handle's not going to close. And they think, okay, well, this lets them know, because if the handle closes properly, that means everything caught and it's locked and it's sealed. But what happens in, so the DC-10 gets delivered, it's certified by the FAA. It takes off. It's a flight from Windsor. Where was the Windsor flight headed, Sammy?
Oh, yeah. You know, that was leaving Detroit. It was going to New York. And that was an absolutely terrifying incident. You read the book. You know what happened. The aft cargo door blew off before they got to 12,000 feet. It was like a hurricane going through the plane. The floor exploded downward. The seats, a bar in the rear of the plane just disappeared. There was a coffin down there that fell out of the plane.
So what happens is the plane is getting ready to take off from Detroit. It's the baggage handler is shutting the cargo door, and shuts it, and then you push this handle in. Well, the handle won't push in. So he keeps reopening and reshutting the door, and it keeps happening. And he asks his supervisor, these DC-10s are funky like this. You got to really push that handle. So they force the handle to close, and it works. So they think, okay, that's how these things are. What happened was they later find out that by forcing too hard that handle, it bent the handle. So the door was never actually sealed, but the handle fit because they were able to force it. And like you said, when they take off, get to the certain height, the pressure that when the, you know, the cabins have to be pressurized so we can breathe, the pressure hits full, it blows the door out, blows a huge hole in the in the plane. But because also another design problem, they didn't design the floor strong enough. Blows a big hole in the floor. And like you said, rows of seats go flying out of the plane. A coffin and cargo goes flying out of the plane. Luckily for the flight, it was a very under-filled flight. There were only like 56 people on board. So luckily there was nobody sitting in the rows that flew. And luckily also that there weren't more people because more weight would have made the hole in the floor even worse. A couple of flight attendants, or at least one, almost got sucked out of the plane but was saved.
Yes.
And only because the pilot had trained for had trained extensively on the DC-10 and had realized that things could go wrong, because another design flaw of the DC-10, right, is if things go catastrophically wrong, all the hydraulics can get knocked out and all sorts of things can get knocked out where you don't have a true manual backup like they always had on other planes up until this point. The pilot actually somehow is able to land the plane, much like the Sioux City plane, by doing something with the engines where he's revving one engine, bringing down another to steer the plane, and they do a crash landing in Windsor, and everybody survives. So
they actually were able to go back. They were actually able to go back to Detroit. The blowout happened over Windsor.
I'm sorry. Okay, that's why I keep saying
Windsor. Airport. You know, it's an incredibly detailed story, but they did make it back there because the captain, Bryce McCormick, had practiced the possibility of partial hydraulic failure on a simulator. And otherwise, he had a strategy, as which you described, for how to use the engines to control the plane.
Yeah.
And it was an incredible feat as a pilot. And so, you know, they had an actual demonstration, a plane of where the aft cargo door blows out. Everyone almost dies, but once again, it's not enough to get them to address the problem.
Well, that's the crazy thing.
Really,
so at this point, we've had the door blow off in the hangar before the plane has ever left the ground. We think, here's what we do. We'll fix this with this. They do a Band-Aid repair on it. Then at one of the first, you know, it's only been in service a few months. This happens. Everybody survives. So you think, okay, wow, we really have a problem. We'll take care of this. Or the FAA will ground the plane. Something will happen. None of this happens.
Right.
So even greater tragedy strikes.
That's right.
Sammy, I'm late for the news. Will you stick with us for a few minutes? Let me take a quick break for the news, and then we'll come back.
Okay, sounds good. Thanks
Excellent.
A lot.
Thank you. Hold on. Sammy Chittum, the author of The Flight 981 Disaster, Tragedy, Treachery, and the Pursuit of Truth, after we check the news. Matt Bobala with you, 720 WGN. Thank you for staying up with us, everybody. Sammy Chittum is on the phone. The Flight 981 Disaster, Tragedy, Treachery, and the Pursuit of Truth. We're talking about the DC-10, the McDonnell Douglas DC-10, which came out in response to the Boeing 747. It was very much rushed into production. When we were speaking before the news, we talked about the cargo door, which had inherent problems from the get-go in the design. It exploded once in a hangar before the plane had ever flown, and then just a few months into service, it explodes on an American Airlines flight that's supposed to be from Detroit to New York. And it's able to land and everybody survives. But clearly there's a bunch of problems with this door. So, Sammy, I was getting yelled at by some listeners to let you talk more because I really dominated that first half hour.
No problem.
I apologize. But go ahead and take it from there.
Okay.
So the crash happens. The cargo door blows up over Windsor. They are able to land the plane in Detroit and everyone survives. So the NTSB gets involved, figures out there are serious problems with that, and they want to take action. Why doesn't it actually happen?
Well, that was one of the most stunning aspects of this thing and why it was a scandal. And by the way, the British journalists, the team from the Sunday Times of London, exposed all this with very deep investigative work. But what happened is that the NTSB investigators did a terrific job. They figured out right away what happened, and they identified the problems with the floor and the door both. And then what the FAA, unfortunately, the NTSB just investigates. and identifies the problems, it's up to the FAA to do something, to order the planes out of service, to issue what they call an airworthiness directive, to basically require the company to repair the doors, to fix them, to address the problem. And what happened was is two guys in suits got on the phone. The head of the FAA, Jack Schaefer, got on the phone with Jackson McGowan, who is president of McDonnell Douglas. And McDonnell Douglas basically said, hey, you know, come on, don't do this to us. You know, this is going to make us look really bad. It's going to cost us a lot of money. Just let us fix the problem ourselves. And they arrived at what they called a gentleman's agreement between the FAA and McDonnell Douglas to let McDonnell Douglas address it. And we know what happened. They didn't. What they came up with were Band-Aid fixes, and even those Band-Aid fixes were not put in place. And the stage was set for this to happen all over again in exactly the same way for exactly the same reasons. And that is what happened 2 years later, 1974, in France.
With Flight 981, the main story of the book, one of those Band-Aid fixes was just a metal bar that needed to go on the door, which was going to prevent being able to force that handle to shut, right? Is that the main purpose of that?
Yeah, I have to put in a good word for the engineers here. I come from a family of engineers. My father was a mechanical engineer. My brother's an engineer. And he looked at this design and he just said, oh my God, this was just such an inadequate repair. Even the repair was a terrible idea. He said they should have just, you know, redesigned the whole door. But there's a possibility if they put in this what they call the support plate or a brace, it would have prevented the door from being forced closed and giving the appearance of being locked when it wasn't. But even that had not been done. And because you read the book, you know that McDonnell Douglas covered that up. They covered up the fact that they didn't put that plate in there. So there was they ignored the warnings that you so clearly discussed, and then they got a special inside gentleman's deal to take care of it. They came up with some really bad fixes, and then they didn't even put those in. And then they tried to hide the fact that all of this had happened. So, you know, it was a really, really disgraceful performance on the part of McDonnell Douglas from beginning to end. And all this was very clearly set out at the time because of the work done by really excellent investigative reporters.
Yeah, you know, the book you can take also as just a lesson in bad corporate crisis management, because from every little accident that happened, McDonnell Douglas seemed to take the track of blaming other people. The baggage handler was illiterate.
Yes.
These people didn't do this. They didn't do that. It does appear, and I don't think you're ever fully able to quite explain it. Maybe it's a mystery of this, but when they go back through all the documents and there are some supervisors who sign off on certain things being done, this plane that the crash flight 981, we talk about how McDonnell Douglas didn't make this repair. McDonnell Douglas sent out a service update to all the airlines that had DC-10 saying you should make these changes to the door. It wasn't, like you said, the airworthiness directive that the NTSB wanted the FAA to issue, which would have grounded all the planes because of the handshake agreement. Planes get to keep flying, but they tell all the airlines, hey, add a peephole to the door so they can look in and make sure it's locked, and put this plate on because that's going to prevent them from forcing the door shut. The plane
and
that
put a warning placard on the outside.
Yeah, right,
that
right.
Was the third thing, right?
And put a sticker that says "Warning: Don't force the door shut, or the whole thing blows up." So the McDonnell Douglas Corporation had six planes that were unsold. A deal with Al Nippon Airways falls through. They got to get these planes moving, and that's the other sort of perfect storm of this is that they make this deal with the Turkish airline. Generally, it takes, I forget how long it was. Was it like 18 months usually to train pilots to fly a new aircraft? It's some inordinately long amount of time if you do it the right way. But Turkish Airlines demanded as part of the deal, you train our pilots within 12 weeks to fly these planes so we can hit the holiday season.
And everyone involved, maintenance and all the people, support personnel, everything. All of a sudden, they were in a big hurry so they could make money, you know, over the holidays. That's exactly right.
So these
didn't work out so well either.
No. So these pilots really have no true training for disaster like this, probably, on this aircraft. The baggage handler who is dealing with it ends up forcing it shut because while the plane was still in the hangar before it had ever, you know, all this comes out before these planes are delivered, McDonnell Douglas themselves do not make the repair they've recommended to all the other airlines. They don't put that metal plate on. But when they're going through all the lawsuits, and they have a piece of paper stamped from a supervisor that says it was done. And you talk in detail about the supervisor's testimony where he's pretty confused about the whole thing, saying, I don't remember ever stamping that, but I had control of my stamp. I don't think it was forged. He can't figure out how that happened. And we still truly don't know to this day how that happened, right?
That's correct. Nobody really knows. I mean, again, these Paul, Eddie, and the team, the Sunday Times team, is the one that went through literally thousands of pages of documents until they got down to this one document that had the stamp on it saying, yes, the plate has been, you know, installed. But, you know, the evidence was there. The plate hadn't been installed. So why was that stamp on the document? And they theorized that one of two things happened, that after the crash, somebody went back and falsified it as a cover-up, or they were just in a hurry. Nobody really checked, and they said, oh, you know, the regular guy didn't put the stamp on here. I'll just do it. Let's, you know, we got to get this plane out of here. We got to sell this thing. Got to get it over. You know, we got to deliver it. So either someone just rushed it through and just put a stamp on it that was missing, you know, without checking the plate, or they intentionally later falsified the document. Yeah. Nobody really knows.
It's such an intricate story with so many things that went awry. We only have a few minutes left, so I want to cover a couple more things. One is, Sam, you've mentioned a few different times these journalists and how the story only truly comes to light because of the lawsuits that were filed, which helps documents be retained and everything happen. And the lawsuits in Los Angeles, because in England, they have very severe, strict limits on the amount of payout in something like this. But of course, here in the States, we have much larger payouts available. So they sue them in California where the planes are built. And these journalists who end up living for a year here talk about how they, because there's a lockdown, they're not supposed to have access to any of this. The judge has ruled that you know, all the documents are kind of under lock and key. So give me a quick scenario on how the two journalists are able to take a look at everything.
It's incredible. They got a source of some kind. Someone had a key to the document room. That was like their deep throat. We don't know who that was. And every night they would go in there, and their lawyer said, okay, you can copy these documents if you put everything back. You probably won't get in trouble if they catch you. But they were doing it every night. They would sneak in there. They'd run in. They'd get all the new documents. They'd take them to a copy shop at the Berkeley, that the students were running. And then they'd put them all back again. And this was all done at night over the course of a year. It was a really exhausting, risky enterprise. And their dedication, their nerve was considerable because they were always in danger of, you know, being caught, literally sneaking these documents out. But they did it, and they were the ones who exposed what had happened, because if they hadn't, it would have all been buried, hidden, kept secret in court records that were never released.
And it was over 50,000 documents, right?
Yeah. It's staggering. They even built a replica of the door. I mean, this was old school journalism.
Yeah.
This was the way it used to be done. This was the real investigative reporting where they left literally no piece of paper unturned. And they're the ones who told this story and showed the whole arc of what happened. And going back to this now, you know, I was able to reconstruct it and add some insights with the benefit of time. But it's really an astonishing story. It's kind of like the spotlight story, you know, for journalism that was never told, but what these reporters did.
The place where the accident happened, Senlis, France, what's the name of the town?
I only had high school French, so I could get in trouble with this. Senlis, I think, is the name of it. It's a small town. It's just a small town next to this huge forest preserve. They had, it was a catastrophic accident that was visited on this very provincial area. They had nowhere to put the bodies. They were completely overwhelmed by what happened to them.
And no way. I mean, this is, this is one of those accidents where it's not like a crash landing or a controlled crash or anything. This is a nosedive, terrible 400 mile an hour where everything is just destroyed and very difficult to even collect bodies because, you know, what happens at 400 miles an hour, everything is pretty obliterated. So it's just terrible. And you write about that, even visiting this area now, there's a bit of a memorial there, but it sounded like, Sammy, that even if you walk around there now, you're going to find bits of airplane and different things still in this forest if you walk around.
Isn't that stunning?
I mean, 40 years later.
Yeah, there were so many thousands and thousands of tiny parts everywhere that the impact was so explosive that there's no way they could really clean it all up. And now, after all this time, it's still possible to pick up a part of an airplane from this crash. There were so many things about this that were just really staggering. Now here we are all these years later, there's still physical evidence at the crash site.
That's the most amazing thing. I mean, that's just hard to fathom that you walk around there now. You say that at the memorial site where they have a little memorial in the names that people leave stuff, and there's bones there. There's all sorts of pieces of the plane there that people pick up and I guess then leave there where the marker is.
Yes. And I have to say, and writing about this and other plane crashes, I now have a much more profound understanding of the importance of these memorials and the importance of allowing relatives to visit the crash site. It's an extremely important part of their ability to deal with this terrible thing that's happened to them. And these memorials serve an important purpose at the time and years later for, children, someone who lost their father when they were small, to go back as an adult the way this one individual did and actually go there and go to the memorial. These memorials are very, very important. This one in particular, I think, is completely unique in its character.
Yeah, no kidding. I want to ask you real quick here before we wrap up, because it was just in the news today that Australia issued their final report on MH370, the Malaysian Airlines flight that disappeared. And we're going on 4 years. It'll be 4 years, I believe, this March since that plane disappeared. And in their final report, Australia wrote, "It is almost inconceivable that we have not found this airline yet." And I was thinking, as I was reading this today, incredible? About those families, and you mentioned how important it is for closure to be able to be in the area where this happened, where your family member lost their life. And these people just have no, 4 years later, assuming everybody's dead, of course, and it's only sort of the conspiracy theorists that think it landed in Russia or whatever. But by never knowing what happened, that just has to be a terrible feeling.
I've got a feeling there'll be someone. I have some friends who do deep underwater exploration, and they can't look indefinitely. But I have a feeling that someone is going to go back. They're going to keep looking, and I don't know if it's going to be 5, 10, or 20 years from now. I think that crash site could eventually still be found because humans, we hate mysteries, and someone's going to try to solve that mystery, and I hope for the sake of everyone affected by it that someday they do.
Yeah, no kidding. Sammy Chittum, the book, The Flight 981 Disaster, Tragedy, Treachery, and the Pursuit of Truth is available now. Thank you so much for jumping on the phone. I really appreciate it. It was fascinating.
Oh, you're terrific, Matt. I'm so impressed, and I'm glad you enjoyed the book, and I hope other people do too.
Thank you, Sammy. I will keep recommending it. I hope we talk again.
Okay, that'd be great, Matt.
All right, thank you so much. Sammy Chittum, again, the Flight 981 disaster. It's fascinating. If you're interested in planes and what happens, there is a, you know, a fascination I think we all have with that. But also just not trusting necessarily that our governments, that are the corporations we rely on, are always doing the right thing. I mean, money does get in the way of a lot of this. And here's a perfect example of a bunch of things going wrong and people not listening to what they should be doing to make things right. We're going to talk about Anne Frank after the news and how a company is trying to use artificial intelligence and big data crunching to figure out some of the mysteries that Anne Frank left behind. After the news, after we catch up on Spots next, 720 WGN.